Good evening, Martin Amis. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. I'm going to read four just not really closely connected paragraphs from a long piece about Islamism. And it's a solemn piece, but these are slightly lighter because they deal not with the opposed ideology but with our own, which is sometimes called Westernism. 2 years ago, I came across a striking photograph in a news magazine. It looked like a crudely cross-sectioned watermelon, but you could make out one or two humanoid features half-submerged in the crimson pulp. It was, in fact, the bravely circularized photograph of the face of a Saudi newscaster who had been beaten by her husband. In an attempted murder, it seems, at the time of his arrest, he had her in the trunk of his car and was taking her into the desert for interment. What has she done to bring this on herself? In the marital home that night, the telephone rang, and the newscaster, a prosperous celebrity in her own right, answered it. She had answered the telephone. Now, male Westerners will be struck here by a dramatic cultural contrast. I know that I, for one, would be far more likely to beat my wife to death if she hadn't answered the telephone. But customs and mores vary from country to country, and you cannot claim that one ethos is better than any other. Osama bin Laden's table talk at Tarnak Farms in Afghanistan, where he helped train his operatives before September 2001, must have included many rolling paragraphs on Western vitiation, corruption, perversion, prostitution, and all the rest. And in 1998, as America dedicated an entire year politically and culturally to Monica Lewinsky, Osama seemed to have good grounds for his most serious miscalculation, the belief that America was a softer antagonist than the USSR. Still, a sympathizer like the American Taliban John Walker Lint, if he'd been there at Tarnak Farms, and if he'd been a lot brighter, might have framed the following argument. Now, Sheikh, would be a good time to strike, John Walker Lint might have said, because the West is enfeebled not just by sex and alcohol, but also by 30 years of multicultural relativism. They'll think suicide bombing is just an exotic foible, like shame and honor killings or female circumcision. Besides, it's religious, and they're always slow to question anything that calls itself that. Within days of our opening outrage, the British royals will go on the road for Islam and stay on it. And you'd be amazed by how long the word Islamophobia, as an unanswerable rebuke, will cover Islamism too. It'll take them years to come up with the word they want, and Islamismophobia clearly isn't any good. Even if the planes operation, that's September the 11th, goes off as gorily as we hope, the liberals will yawn and say America had it coming and wonder why we waited so long. Strike now. Whatever we do, the liberals will be saying that it's all their fault. Their ideology will make them reluctant to see what it is they confront, and it will make them slow learners. Then with a little jump, there is one more symbiotic overlap between Islamist culture and praxis and our own, and it is a strange and pitiable one. I mean the drastic elevation of the non-entity. In our popularity contest culture, with its red-carpeted ciphers and meteoric mediocrities, we understand the attractions of baseless fame, indeed, of instant and unearned immortality. To feel that you are a geo-historical player is a tremendous lure to those condemned, as they see it, to exclusion and anonymity. In its quieter way, this was perhaps the key component of the attraction of Western intellectuals to Soviet communism. Join, and you are suddenly a contributor to planetary events. As Mohammed Atta steered the 767 towards its destination, he was confident at least that his fellow town planners in Aleppo would remember his name, along with everybody else on Earth. Similarly, the ghost of Shizad Tanweer, as it watched the salvage teams scraping up human remains in the rat-infested cauldron beneath the streets of London, could be pretty sure he had decisively outsoared the fish and chip shop back in Leeds. And Azama, he is ever living. Now I'll just close, if I may, with the best 150 or so words I've ever read on religious belief or faith. Recently and rather endearingly defined as, quote, the desire for the approval of supernatural beings. It's terribly sweet, that, isn't it? It is from Joseph Conrad. Conrad wrote with amazing predictive power about terrorism in Under Western Eyes and The Secret Agent. But this is from the author's note to the great secularist novella, The Shadow Line, and it is dated 1920. The world of the living contains enough marvels and mysteries as it is, marvels and mysteries acting upon our emotions and intelligence in ways so inexplicable that it would almost justify the conception of life as an enchanted state. No, I'm too firm in my consciousness of the marvelous to be ever fascinated by the mere supernatural, which, take it any way you like, is but a manufactured article, the fabrication of minds insensitive to the intimate delicacies of our relation to the dead and to the living in their countless multitudes, a desecration of our tenderest memories, an outrage on our dignity. Whatever my native modesty may be, it will never condescend to seek help for my imagination within those vain imaginings common to all ages, and that in themselves are enough to fill all lovers of mankind with unutterable sadness. Thanks very much. Good night.